Somebody has provided me with a new sign so that when I need it, I will have it. And I'll try to keep it where it doesn't go hiding from me and can't find it again. Somebody else has brought in the article that some of you may have seen in the Richmond newspaper. Coach McPhee, who we were building some relationship with his team at his high school, is apparently back in coaching. Some of the health problems appear to have cleared up enough that he can begin to work. I think it's Cosby, is that right? Cosby High School. Our relationship isn't so much with him, but the school and the students that he was working with when he was at Huguenot High, and that's where our attention and our connection still is. But it's nice to know that, other young men are having a chance to have that. So I thank the person who provided me this, and I'll try not to lose it. Now, I can't quite hear you, so. All right, we have begun a series, Lessons From, and I had promised you that we might keep this going a little while. I want to talk this morning about lessons from children. And to do this, I'd like you to turn to Matthew chapter 19 for us to start. Those of you who took seats towards the front to leave seats open in the back, I want to thank you for doing that, but it looks like it still is an issue because I don't see any seats in the back. But Matthew 19, and I want to start at verse 13. But you'll find that place. People then brought little children to him, that is to Jesus, for him to lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples had an interesting response. What was their response? Rebuked. Mine says scolded, and somebody says sent them away or turned them away. Or tried to. But Jesus said, leave the little children alone. Do not stop them from coming to me. For it is to such as these that the kingdom of heaven belongs. Then he laid his hands on them and went on his way. I'd like you to turn to Luke chapter 18. You can hold your place there if you like, but I'd like you to turn to Luke chapter 18. I'd like you to read starting at verse 15 and see if you can note the differences. This is a parallel section. See if you can note the differences. Luke 18, starting at verse 15. What are the differences you note? In the first, in my translation, it said lay his hands on them. In my translation for this, it says touch them. Okay? In the other one, it said children. This one in my translation says babies or infants. Okay? And in my translation, and it's almost like it's a reaction to the other, although I don't think it is, it says people even brought babies to them. Almost as if, well, surely they were bringing children. We knew that. But they were bringing babies as well. Jesus called the children to them and said, let them come to me, do not stop them. It is to such as these that the kingdom belongs. And then in my translation, I've got an extra sentence. That's verse 17 here. Do you have that?
Yes.
What's the essence of that sentence? What should it say? In the section in Matthew, you could say, gosh, it sounds like those words are saying that the only people who are going to get into heaven are little children. And in this translation, there's a little bit of a fine-tuning of that. What does it say? Okay, there's the word.
I was hoping somebody would say it, and somebody has. We're going to do it. Did you hear the word she said?
We have to be
childlike. What is the other word we could have used?
Childish.
Childish. And I want to propose is, as we think about lessons we can learn from children as we read through Scripture, I want you to have in mind, and in mind from right now, there's a difference between those two words. I started to ask you if there was a difference. I'd rather not do that. I'd rather assert that there's a difference, and if anybody wants to fight, we can fight. There is a difference between these two. Welcome the kingdom as a little child. Have you ever seen an excited child? If you have watched carefully in past weeks, you may have seen a moment that for me is one of the most delightful moments I have at church. Sometimes now, at the first of this hour, while you guys are all milling around up there, there's a little girl that comes through that door. Her granddaddy stands in the door. He comes to the 11 o'clock hour, but he brings her in here, and at 9:30 she comes running across. Usually I'm over in here somewhere the last couple of times it's happened, and she gives me a big hug. And we talk to each other for a moment, and then she goes off to the rest of the place. I have worked really hard to get to know this little kid. I've worked really hard to get to know her. Her name is Hannah, and she lives with and is cared for by her granddad, who is a single parent. And it's a neat, neat story. This one child is the one I think of when I ask that question. Have you ever seen a kid happy? Have you ever seen a kid happy because you're in the room? That one's good. That is what this sentence is saying. Unless you can welcome the kingdom like these little children are happy to see me, unless you're as happy to be in my presence as these little children are to be in my presence, you may not be ready yet to be in the kingdom. But when you come to that point, so what I propose is we begin to fill out up here what Jesus meant by the lessons we can learn. And if you give me things that belong on that side, I'll put them over there. But I think this is the side, the childlike side that Jesus was talking about, not the childish side. We're not talking about the tantrums that children sometimes throw when they're upset or tired or aren't getting their way. We're talking about the other things. Okay? Now, before we finish, there are three Gospels that are so-called synoptic. That's derived from a Greek word. Do you remember the pastor, if you've been at 11 o'clock, he gave you a Greek lesson today. Remember what that word was?
Metanoia.
Those of you who haven't been yet, watch for that word. You'll get a Greek lesson this morning. The word I just gave you is synoptic. Optic means with the eye, and sin means the same. There are three Gospels that are called synoptic Gospels because there are passages like this one that are parallel in all three. But it's sort of like last week we talked about 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, and then 1st and 2nd Chronicles passes through the same thing. When you have these, each one offers something a little different. So you look at Matthew first and then look at Luke and you've got a little bit more. I want to take you to the third one, which is the third of these Gospels. Mark, bravo, not John. John's a little bit different. But I want to take you to Mark, and I'd like you to look in Mark chapter 10. I'll give you the exact verse in just a minute because I didn't write it down.
Verse 13,
thank you. Okay, and once again, I want you to look through here and see if you can see a difference between the first two and this one. Bringing little children to him, touched them, scolded. It says this time Jesus was indignant. It gives you a little bit of his. What's he saying? You have just done the opposite of what you should be doing. And you should have known better. Indignant and said to them. And then verse 14, verse 15, pretty much a parallel of what we read in Luke, I think, and maybe in Matthew. But once again, you get to the last of these verses, verse 16. And what's the picture you have here? He takes them in his arms. Mine says he embraces them. I think there are other translations that says he picks them up in his arms. There's this beautiful picture of connectedness. Not just reaching out and touching, but actually sort of transferring.
And bless them.
And bless them. Uh-huh. Okay? How are you doing so far?
Because now what I want to do, you've seen the three places. Matthew 19, Luke 18, Mark 10. You've seen those three places. I want you to go back now and tell me what story or what moment or what incident immediately follows this one. You could actually look at any one because it's the same one in all three. Now, what was the question the rich young ruler asked? How can I enter the kingdom? What must I do to be part of the kingdom? Isn't that interesting? Jesus had just answered the question. And I don't think I'd ever noticed that before. Jesus says, you want to be part of the kingdom, come in with a childlike faith. Learn how to be childlike again. Pause for just a moment. Mike, just come around the outside of here. A long time ago, we had the state medical examiner for Virginia. Come all the way up here. This is the missionary work I've been telling you all to do. You know, leave the empty seats in the back and everything will be happier.
Being good, don't
scare them off. Right, that's what we're going to try to do. A long time ago, some of you know Patricia Cornwell's novels focused on the state medical exam. Ferrero, I think, is her name. She's coming to the university to speak, and we took one of the largest rooms we had, set up chairs in it. There were maybe 450 chairs. And I was sitting about the fourth row on the left-hand side, and in front of us, or my colleague and I were sitting there, in front of us was a young woman with an empty seat. And this elderly woman came up, this older woman came up, and started to sit in the empty seat. And the young lady sitting there says, no, you can't sit there. I'm saving that for my friend. And the older woman says, well, I'm really tired. How about this? Let me sit there, and when the speaker starts to talk, I'll get up and let your friend have the seat then, or if your friend comes in early. So the girl says, well, I guess so. She says, yeah. The person walks up front and gives this beautiful introduction to Dr. Ferrero. And then says, and Dr. Ferrero, and the older woman stands up, walks to the front, begins to speak. My colleague was quicker than I. He starts kicking the chair of this young lady and says, you feel bad now, don't you? So, it's nice to have the room full. That is a good problem to have. But my friend Bob told me this morning, you'll notice I'm sitting way up here. I'm doing some missionary work this morning. Okay, back to where we were. We're looking in Matthew 19, Luke 18, Mark 10. We just read the story about Jesus and the little children. And in that story, Jesus says, if you want to be part of the kingdom, you need to develop a childlike faith. And immediately after, there's the second story. And I had not put these two together before. It's the story of the rich young ruler. What's his question? How can I be part of the kingdom? Must not have listened. And Jesus says to him, well, you got the Ten Commandments. How about trying a few of those? And he doesn't list them all. He just lists a few. Wonders why he chose those and not the others. One could speculate, but one won't. The man said to him, Master, I have kept all of these since my earliest days. Did you catch that little phrase? I hadn't caught that little phrase before. And what does Jesus do? We're in Mark, so this is the one to look at. Verse 21. What did Jesus do? He didn't speak yet. He didn't speak yet. What did he do? He looked at him, and mine says steadily. And loved him. And said to him, the things that stand between you and God, get rid of them. I don't think we are called on to give away all of our money. But this person was. Because that was what was standing between him and God. Okay. What does it mean to be childlike? What are the characteristics of a child
the positive characteristics that Jesus was likely talking about? Oh, good. I got 15 answers. Run over here. Trust. I'm going to say capable of being excited. Because if they stay excited all the time, that's no fun. That's no fun. We call that, when we were raising our kids, we call that hyperdrive. They go into a hyperdrive. You could ever get them still for 3 minutes, they drop off like rocks.
Curious.
Unencumbered. Oh, I like that.
I would love it.
And let me expand on that a little bit. They're capable of giving and receiving love without really thinking about it too much. Now, somebody else offered one.
With curious, you could put open.
Mm-hmm. Open.
Unprejudiced. They don't have prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's the right word.
Yeah, and that's different from this, but I'm just placing it here because I think it's close to this.
Of course, Newsweek magazine questioned that this week.
Really?
Grateful. Time magazine this week had a big article on what colleges are doing because of the recession. And they said some colleges were cutting back on cutting the lawn. They're going to cut the grass less often. And others are going to do this or that. And they said, I think it was Arizona State, was going to close 48 degree programs. Now listen carefully. From art history to archaeology. That's the A's to the A's. And they're doing 48 just there. And I started to think, well, you know, is biology and botany going to be in the next 48 to be cut? I don't know. But anyway. Yeah, Newsweek and Time do say interesting things from time to time. Unprejudiced. Do you know the song? I can't remember who wrote it. I'm thinking Tom Lehrer, but I may not be right. You have to be carefully taught. Was that out of that was out of The King and I, wasn't it? It was out of a Broadway play somewhere. Yeah. You have to be carefully taught. Talking about how children have to learn to be great. So I don't know what Newsweek was talking about. I think there is an innocence there, but I don't know how early it begins to be affected by things. What else? I heard Robbie Zacharias one time say, one of the problems with growing up is that it takes more and more and more to excite you. He said, for example, if I were to talk to my three children and tell them a story, and I said to the oldest one, I can't remember his name, he's got two boys and a girl, and I can't remember. He said, if I talked to the first one, and I said, there was a little boy named Tommy, and Tommy got up and walked to the door and turned the knob and opened the knob, and a tiger came out. He would get all excited when the tiger came out. But if I went to the next one, the younger one, and I said, the little boy got up, walked to the door, and turned the knob, he'd get excited with the turning of the knob because he hadn't learned to do that yet. That was the thing that was keeping him from going all the places he wanted to go. And when he talked to the little one, the little boy got up. She got excited because she couldn't get up yet. And so there's a sort of a jaded view that might creep in when you get old enough. And the simple things don't excite you as much. They make jokes about the parents who get mad because they buy expensive presents for the kids at Christmas time and the kids play with the boxes because the boxes are fun. I think there's something.
Yes, sir. You know, his answers to receive. God has made us a lot of offers. Childlikeness, when I offer a child something, he grabs hold of it, asks us to receive, receptive. There's a lot that the Lord is offering all of us that we have not received.
Okay. The big word is receptive, but the illustration is ready or anxious to receive. If I'm going to offer somebody something, little kids, they'll take it. Mm-hmm. And I love the way you put that. God is ready to give us good things. What was the story Jesus said about that?
If you're a father and your kid asks you for a loaf of bread, are you going to give them a stone? If they ask you for, I forget what it was, an egg or something like that, are you going to give them a scorpion? No, no. The Father gives good things. And Bob is reminding us,
kids are ready to take things we offer. We would question her.
Even the strings are attached.
What else? I appreciate you're not putting anything that deserves a place over here.
Full of
To a point.
Yeah.
And then totally terrified.
We joke about our grandson.
He, any room he walks into, he assumes he owns that room. Teachable. I started thinking about you yesterday as I was pondering this. And I thought about Kitty yesterday as I was pondering this.
Do you know what Kitty and Judith have in common? Those of you who don't know her real well don't know these ladies. They teach foreign languages. It's a whole lot easier to learn a foreign language between the ages of 3 and 5 than it is between the ages of and Willie is. Willie's not going to do that yet.
Willie's already done.
That's. I'm impressed, gentlemen. I'm impressed. What else?
Can I tell you my favorite story about this particular subject?
A long time ago, Barbara and I spent a year in Columbus, Ohio. I was a student at Ohio State University. I finished my PhD and I was in what they call a postdoctoral experience. And there was a guy who was there on sabbatical from a school in Maryland. And the two of us rode to work. We carpooled to work together. They had a daughter exactly to the day, one year older than our daughter. And so there was this one time we went out to eat together. Now, child protection in cars in those days was not as sophisticated as it is today. So they had a child seat that clamped over the back seat. And a little seat, and a little tray, and a little steering wheel. Okay? Came to a stoplight. The light turns green. The car in front of us did not move. And this little kid, who was between the ages of 1 and 2, because our daughter was between the ages of 0 and 1, hits the horn 2 times and shouts, "Move it, fathead." We're in the back seat with our daughter. They're in the front seat with their daughter. The wife turns to the husband and said, "Where did she get that?" And the husband says, "I have no idea. I had ridden to work with him. I had been on the second car back. I had seen the hand hit the horn and the move it fat head, and I think he must not have done that when his wife was in the car, but he sure did it when his daughter was in the car." Are they impressionable? You bet. You bet.
Once again, the impressions God would like to give us lead us in good works. Sometimes we as earthly parents don't do as good a job. But, you know, if we take our impressioning from the right place, things will be good. What else? You know, I think I'm just going to put that as an alternative to this.
Okay.
If you want your children to do something, you do it. If you don't want them to do something, don't you do it.
What about willing to help with the work? If you're doing something that comes and want to help me.
Yeah, real little.
I actually teach polarity and covalent bonding with that story. A long time ago, we had a place that had tons of leaves falling down, and at that time we cared about getting the leaves off the yard. We don't care quite as much anymore. But I was out raking leaves, and Brian was maybe four, and he came out and said, "Daddy, can I help?" And I knew if I wanted him to help when he was 16, I had to let him help me. So I got him a rake, you know, bigger than he was by far, and gave him the rake and said, "Okay, you rake over there." And it took him, Brian's a smart kid, it took him all of 2 minutes to realize that if you turn the rake where the tines went this way, down, that was hard work. So he turned it over and rode the yard like this, and things went much better for him. Okay? We got finished. I sat down on the front steps. He sat down on the front steps. Barbara brought each of us out something, drank lemonade or something. And my next door neighbor, who was sort of like a surrogate grandfather for Brian, came walking over and looked at me and said, "You've been working hard, huh?" And Brian says, "Boy, have we ever." And he wiped his hand. Okay. I think it's real significant. Whoever said when they're real little, that emphasizes, I think, the point that Jesus was making. There are things that little children will do instinctively and naturally that adults, it's almost like they've forgotten how. So, willing to help in the work, yeah. What else?
A desire to please.
Desire to please. Which I think connects with several of these. What else?
Here.
I like that. Can I lay that somewhere near here?
Sure.
Sorry.
Most of them know maybe not to God. They just have the assurance that they are principles and accepted.
I wish that I could be sure that all of them had an assurance of belonging to God, but I think at its best, a child would know that they belong, and one would hope that they would understand that may be something else that they need to learn later and transfer them. What else? Right? Mr. God Changer?
I think sometimes children can be brutally honest.
I was waiting for that one to go up, and if it wasn't, I'm coming.
Sometimes a reflection of yourself, and you go, "Oh, wow, that's what I said." I think their minds are now being polluted. They're sort of just seeing things purely for what they are.
Maybe bluntly, maybe brutally so. I can't remember now if it's Dennis the Menace, I think, that plays on that the most, where visitors come over to the house and he tells them what his parents have been saying about it. It's horribly, but what you said. Yes. What else?
I think it's a baby last night. We got a perfect attempt. He was, he got his bottle.
In spite of the smoke running across where he was sitting and the mosquitoes flying around, didn't bother him at all. Just slept for what? Okay, I had written down the ones I wanted to make sure we talked about were trust, willing to try new things, accepting of others. Little children are colorblind. Deeply honest. You've given me a much better list up here. I want to talk about trust for a minute. How do you teach a child to swim? You got two choices. One is to pick them up and throw them in. What's the other one? You get in the water and do what? Let them jump to you. Now, I know there's lots more to that, but just stop that far. Just stop that far. Throw them in the deep end, let them sink or swim. Or what? You get in the water and say, come to me. It's that second picture the children respond to. It's that second picture the children respond to. In the sense of trust, the child wants to be with you, and even though where you happen to be is a pretty scary place, they still want to be with you. I had an interesting experience this summer. We spent a night or two while we were on a brief vacation out towards Texas. We weren't in Texas yet. At a hotel that was built on the edge of a big cliff, and they had built a swimming pool on the edge of that cliff. So there were poles that started down at the bottom of the cliff, went up 45, 50 feet, maybe more, and held up a swimming pool. You could see the bottom of the swimming pool from it. And to get to the swimming pool, you went to the seventh floor of the hotel, and then you walked out on a deck that was suspended up that way. And the swimming pool had a lower pool, and then further up the cliff, they had a higher pool. Okay, I'm trying to remember, I think the higher pool was about 4 feet deep, 3 feet deep, something like that.
Is it?
No, there's one up there that was more shallow. That was the higher one, right? The lower one was 6.5 feet tall. Was 6.5 feet deep, excuse me. Now, I got in that pool, and it didn't have a shallow end, and it didn't have a deep end. It had 6.5 feet through the whole thing. 6.5 feet is here. I got to tell you, except, you know, momentary excursions into the deep end, I come back into the shallow end, and I can stand up almost any shallow end there ever was. There was an entire pool where I could not touch bottom and still breathe. Nowhere in that pool. And there was no gradation in it. You, in the pool, that was it. And I started to think, as I was dealing with this yesterday, being asked to jump in, that's every pool feels like that to a three-year-old or a four-year-old. All those pools are way over my head. And there are some things they instinctively know, and they know I don't want to go in there. So throw them in, yeah. But if you get in the pool, and if they have enough trust, if they believe you, I'll help you. I'll catch you. Jump to me. And when they do, they get so excited, and it's a moment of joy. Okay. I want to take a few minutes. I think I've got about 10 or 12 minutes left. And I want to start and move to particular examples. And I only have time to do one or two. I'm going to do the quick one first. If you'll turn to Acts chapter 12. This is not a section that you would ever think would be associated with the idea of lessons from children. But I want you to take a look at this. Acts chapter 12, verse 1. It was about this time that King Herod started persecuting certain members of the church. He had James, the brother of John, beheaded. And when he saw this pleased the Jews, he went on to arrest Peter as well. If you keep reading, Peter is in jail, expecting to be beheaded at almost any moment. And God sends angels, and a miracle occurs. Peter is walking out of a jail that he can't possibly walk out of. If you take a look on verse 6, he was asleep, chained to two different soldiers. And guards were at watch at the gates, inside and outside the prison. And the chains fall loose and the guards fall asleep. And the angel says to Peter, get up and get going. Peter thought he was just having a dream, but kind of a pretty good dream, so he went along with it. He gets outside, gets out of the street, the angel goes away, and there's Peter all by himself. That was the end of verse 10. Only then did Peter come to himself. Verse 11 says, the Lord really did send his angel. So what did he do? He goes to where all the believers were. They were all sitting there, and what were they praying for? They were praying that a miracle would happen and Peter would somehow get out of jail. So far, okay? You're ahead of me. That's good. Are you reading in verse 12 and 13? A number of people had assembled at the home of Mary, the mother of John Mark, and they were praying, almost certainly praying that Peter would be experiencing a miracle. He knocked at the outside door, and a little servant girl named Rhoda came to the door. What does it say about her reaction? She was overjoyed, my translation says. Okay, there's joyed, and there's overjoyed. When you're overjoyed, you sometimes don't think about what you do very much. What did she do when she was overjoyed? She didn't even open the door. She had opened probably a little portal in the door where she could see outside. She was so overjoyed, she didn't even open the door. She went running inside to where they were praying. What were they praying for? That a miracle would take Peter and let him out of jail. And she says to them, there's been a miracle. Peter's out of jail. He's at the door. What did they say to her? Shut up, kid. We're praying for Peter to get out of jail. It took some convincing. Why? Because sometimes people don't read the joy of little children. Somewhere in here, it's sort of a connection between happy and content, bold and fearless, impressionable, willing to help with the work. Somewhere in there is being filled with joy at the right times. And she was. I like that story. What did they say to her? This fits with what the pastor talked about this morning. You're out of your mind. Praying for Peter's release from jail and a miracle. Rhoda says, it's happened, he's outside. Yeah, you're out of your mind. Peter, meanwhile, was still knocking. And finally, they go to the door. Sometimes when children see the truth and tell the truth bluntly and honestly, people don't always want to accept it, even when children have seen the truth. I liked that little piece of that. Let me take you for a moment to Daniel chapter 1. This one's a bit more serious. Daniel chapter 1. Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea. If you find Hosea, back up. Daniel chapter 1. Many of you will know the story. The rest of you who don't can skim as we talk. You need to read the first 20 verses of chapter 1, and then eventually skip over to chapter 3 and read the first 20 or 30 verses there. But let's see if we can get the story. The southern kingdom has been overrun by Babylon, and the Babylonian king has done what he did in every other country he conquered. What did he do? He took the young children, the impressionable, teachable children, and taught them the ways of the Babylonians. They're called Chaldeans in mind, but that's the same group. Okay? And what he did was, he was putting them into service of Babylon. They learned Babylon work. These children were apparently old enough to have learned enough about the God of Israel that when that time came, a few of them, a very small number, said, this is not the way we're supposed to do things. A foreign power has come in. They probably killed your parents in front of your eyes. They have probably marched you in chains across to a strange country. And then all of a sudden, they offer you all the food you want to eat when you've been starving. They offer you a soft bed when you've been having to sleep on the ground. And they offer you kindness instead of beatings. It almost always works. But these little children said something else. They said, we're not supposed to live this way. We're not supposed to eat these things. There's other things we're supposed to eat. The dietary laws that they had been raised with, they said, we want to follow those. The person who is in charge of the group says, it's my head if I don't do exactly what the king has told me to do. Now, this is the part that normally, I think, would not appear on this list. But when you see it, it's wonderful. And that's the word courageous. Now, I think somewhere you've got curious and you've got bold and fearless That's I think some combination of that is what I'm talking about here. But there's a step beyond that. It's a step of once having learned the simple things, they're ready to say, it's simple what we need to do here. It's not complicated. And although somebody with pretty persuasive powers is trying to turn them, they don't turn. Do you remember the outcome? Who were these four kids? What's the name of the book? That's the first one. And who are the other three? You know the Babylonian names that these guys were given. And I think that if you take a look in verse 7 or 6, it shows you their Hebrew names and then the Babylonian names that replace those. I know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I don't know the Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. I don't know those three names. But those were their Hebrew names. Anybody remember what Daniel's name was?
Belteshazzar.
They all got new names. What was the outcome? The outcome was what they had asked to do was working. They were learning faster. They were growing better. The differences, and that was allowed to stand. Now, in chapter 2, a time had come when the king had a dream. Nobody could interpret that dream. Of all the people whose job it was to interpret dreams, none of them could. Daniel did that. So Daniel got some standing. But when you get to chapter 3, the people whose standing had been taken over, right? If you give somebody significant places, that means somebody else doesn't have those significant places. There's jealousies. And they started to look at how they could trap them. They tried to trap Daniel later. That's where the lion's den came from. This time they're trying to catch the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You remember the basis on which they caught them? They convinced the king to build a giant golden idol. And they got the king to issue a command that said, anybody, we're going to blow the trumpets. And when we blow the trumpets, you're supposed to fall to the ground and worship that idol. And if you don't, you're going to die. How are you going to die? You're going to be thrown into a fiery furnace. And predictably, those three boys didn't. We're not sure where Daniel was. Commentators are silent on that. Why wasn't Daniel part of this? Maybe he was on some trip to another country and didn't get caught up in the turmoil. I don't know. But it was these three. What they said to the king when the king was getting ready to deal with this is the part that's amazing. I think they were still children, but we don't know. They were certainly, I think, still young men. The king says to them, and you can almost hear him say, look, this is pretty easy. I know you don't believe in this stuff, but just when the trumpet sounds, just fall down. Just do that and just get this over. I don't want to kill you. Young men said something back. Now, before I tell you this, I need to tell you a story I heard one time. I believe it's true. Some of you know a little something about World War II, and some of you may remember the early days of World War II. The British sent an army into France to try to fight, and that army got pushed back to the English Channel. And that army was evacuated in one of the miracles of World War II by every boat in southern England and every boat that they could find in that part of France, ferrying them across the English Channel. What was the name of the place? The famous name? Dunkirk. I'm told that the general at Dunkirk got some kind of a message, a wireless message, from England saying, we don't think we're going to be able to evacuate you. We don't think we can get you out. Turned out they did, but they thought they couldn't. And I'm told the general sent back a telegram that had, or a message that had three words. And those words quoted from these three boys from the middle of this story. And his telegram was, but if not. Quote mark, but if not. Close quote mark. If you take a look, it's in verse 17, verse 18, verse 19. It's out of the King James Version that particular phrase comes. If you have a modern translation, it may not have the phrase quite the same way. But the boys say to the king, King, we understand what you're trying to do. We thank you for your kindness in offering us a way out. But understand, O king, we can't worship this idol. We simply will not. And the God we serve is capable of saving us from the death that you have in store for us. He is capable of it. But even if he doesn't, understand, we're taking a stand here. It is hard for anybody to take a stand. It is way harder for people to take a stand under circumstances like this. If you ever see that, you have seen something remarkable. If you've ever been involved in that, it stays with you the rest of your life. That is hard to do. These three boys took a stand. They got thrown into the fiery furnace, and there's a point in which the king says, "Why aren't they dead? Why are they still walking around? And wait a minute, how many did we throw in there? I thought we threw three in there. I see four." God doesn't always save you. I came in this morning, and we have a radio station we listen to. At the fear of some mirth and abuse later on, I will tell you that the station, I think, is AM 950. And if you listen at exactly 7:30, you will hear the cheesiest little song that tells you the time that you will ever hear in your life. And just before or just after, I heard somebody sing in a terrible voice and a horrible song and poorly sung, "God will always rescue you. God will always get you up." Even the choir this morning sang, "If the floods come, they won't overwhelm you. You walk through the fire, you won't be consumed." But in this life, in this work, in this side of heaven, sometimes people do die. God doesn't protect them. As I started reading this, one of the things that I was brought to was the story of the children that were raised from the dead. Elijah and Elisha both raised children from the dead. Jesus did. But sometimes children die and they're not raised from the dead. They're not brought back. "But if not," expresses a level of faith that a child might say, "My Father is capable. My Father can deliver me. And even if at this time he doesn't choose to, I'm still going to trust him." Hiding somewhere in there, I think, is what Jesus is trying to say here. I want to close, and we have just a little bit of time left, by just going all the way back to what we saw in Matthew 19. And I want to back up to Matthew 18. I think that's the right place to do this. Matthew 18. And I want you to look at the first verse. "At this time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" What did Jesus do? He brought a little child and put him in the middle of them. And he said, "In truth I tell you, unless you change and become," let me use this word now, "childlike in your faith, you'll never even enter the kingdom of heaven." And so the one who makes himself childlike, like this little child, is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus' measure for greatness in the kingdom is this measure. And that's a pretty important lesson we can learn from children. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the children around us. We thank you for the memories of when we were children, because you never let those memories die unless all of memory has died. We pray that you would teach us to be childlike, to have a trust in you that is so strong that the circumstances the world throws at us will not throw it that away from us. To teach us to be open to the new things you have to show us, responsive, impressionable, teachable, willing to try the things you want us to try, willing to go the places you want us to go. And always in all of that, to be excitable about those moments in which you give us a glimpse of who you are and what you're doing. We thank you that you love us. We thank you that you call us. And we pray this in your Son's name. Amen.